Millions of companies want to make $1 million, but the reality is a lot of them are thinking they need to have capital or they need to raise capital from investors. And that's why Moema Lombe will tell us why that's not necessarily true. And he'll tell us about how you too can make your first $1 million without capital raise. Now, Moema is a tech founder, angel investor, and bootstrapping expert who has helped multiple startups launch and scale without traditional venture capital. He built and scaled a consulting company to five figures in revenue in just 30 days. And he's the author of The Startup Funding Dictionary and the Bootstrapped Startup Founding Playbook. And he has invested in 15 startups with five successful exits. So Moema, tell us about what are the biggest misconceptions around making your first $1 million.
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu. Mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me, Lily. So the biggest misconceptions about making your first $1 million is that you need to raise venture capital. That's one path to building and scaling a company, but that's one of many paths to building and scaling a company.
Thank you. So what's the blueprint for a company that wants to make its first $1 million without capital raise?
Absolutely. So the blueprint for a company to make its first $1 million without capital raise is, number one, finding a big problem. So finding a problem that many people have. Number two is identifying and talking to 10 to 20 target customers, validate their painful problem, then build a solution to that problem, and then have your customers fund that problem. And you can do that all without venture capital. And then you reinvest that company, that customer revenue, into the business to grow it and scale it.
Thank you. If someone wants to make their first $1 million without funding, what's the real path versus the one Silicon Valley sells? Is it the one you just talked about?
Exactly. So there are many paths. And so, for example, I'll give you, in the book, I talk about how there are many companies that we know that started by bootstrapping, right? Jeff Bezos, Amazon, his family gave him about $250,000 to start. Google started with some grant money before they built and scaled with venture capital. So there are many ways to start. One path is through traditional bootstrapping only. One path is bootstrapping and venture capital. Another path is going straight to venture capital. But what no one talks about is that only 1-2% of companies successfully raise venture capital or successfully raise angel funding. Most people start with bootstrapping, and bootstrapping comes in many forms. Bootstrapping can be customer revenue. Bootstrapping can be a home equity line of credit. Bootstrapping can be your credit cards. Bootstrapping can be customer pre-sales. Bootstrapping can be crowdfunding. So there are many creative ways to raise money to get your company started. Now, it's also important to highlight that bootstrapping is ideal for some businesses and not others. For example, if you're building something on a massive scale, for example, like SpaceX, you're not going to be able to do that with your personal credit cards, right? So it's about selecting a proven business model that is ideal for bootstrapping to begin with.
Thank you. What's the best way to establish what's the best pricing for the problem that you have already validated your 10, 20 customers have?
Sure. So in terms of validating the pricing, I'm going to give you the consulting answer. It depends. So you want to make a profit. So you want to make sure that you've built in profit to your pricing. So at a minimum, you want to think about 30 to 35%. But the best way to do it is to do testing, right? So when you do your customer survey of 10 to 20 customers and talking to the target customers and what their problem and pain points are, asking them, what would they be willing to pay for this problem solution that you're developing? And then when they tell you that what they're willing to pay, see if you can charge them on the spot. Are they willing to give you their credit card today for you to give them the solution tomorrow? And then by asking them what their price is, you have a sense of what their pricing should be. And then also you have to do some analysis to make sure that that pricing, you can deliver that product or service at a profitable way to you. Otherwise, you don't have a business.
Thank you. What's the best way to establish which brand messaging you should have so that you're not only getting your first 10, 20 customers that could potentially be your friends, but you're getting like a larger number of interested customers? And how do you even know how to create that kind of messaging that will appeal to a broader range of people?
Sure. So the old way is to do customer research, to do customer surveys, to hire market research personnel at very expensive ways. Rates, but now in the age of AI, you can use any LLM prompted appropriately to help tweak your customer messaging. The first step is to identify the problem you're solving. Next is what is your solution. You also want to identify who is your customer, where are they in the stratosphere in terms of are they a budget customer, are they a luxury customer, and all that information will determine your pricing structure and also, of course, your messaging to that customer base.
Thank you. What about if you started out delivering your product to a customer that can only afford a certain price point, which I would call the Primark customer, and then you actually, from the very beginning, you really wanted to appeal to a luxury customer, but you haven't been able to sell to that luxury customer, but you were able to obtain the first 10, 20, 50 customers at a lower price point. And now let's say you want to move into your ideal customer, which is this super high ticket customer. How do you move from like one target market to another?
Great question. Once again, I'm going to give you the consulting answer. It depends. So there are many ways to do that. I'm going to give you two examples. One example is around a luxury clothing line. And another example is around apps. So when you think about, so to answer your question at a macro level, there are multiple ways to do it. You can do a low ticket item and you can also do a high ticket item. You can also relaunch as a luxury brand. So for example, when I think about luxury clothing, I look at, for example, Ralph Lauren, right? Ralph Lauren has a store on Madison Avenue in New York City, a beautiful old mansion. They have Ralph Lauren, they have Ralph Lauren Black Label, super high end. But then they also have Polo. They also have Chaps at the low end. So they're appealing to customers across the spectrum and across the luxury spectrum and across the budget spectrum. So to answer your question, you can have another example is, for example, a Porsche, right? So you can have a base Porsche. Or you could have the most luxury custom Porsche that possible, depending on your budget. Another example I'll give you is for apps. Historically, I'm aware that certain apps, before they launch in the USA, will launch in Canada, test the market, see the response, work on their messaging, work on their branding, and they'll launch with a fake name and a fake brand, shut it down, use out all that data, and then relaunch in America with a brand and the messaging accordingly. So to answer your question, it depends on which strategy you want to take. Do you want to go to broaden your product line, to do offer more services or more products at a higher end? Or do you want to shut down the budget brand and then launch a luxury brand? So it depends on the mission and vision of the company and what you want to achieve.
Thank you. Can a luxury brand launch from scratch without testimonials? Or would you say, actually, no, it's impossible to? Because let's say you're launching, I don't know, a luxury fashion line or, I don't know, car or something. Like, how do you convince someone to give you money when you're like literally brand new? How do you make this happen?
Sure. So the question is, how can you launch a luxury brand without testimonials?
Yeah.
I'm a big believer that anything is possible. So let's define, what do you mean by testimonials? Do you mean testimonials that people speaking about the brand and how lovely it is? Or do you mean testimonials in terms of, when I think of testimonials, I'm usually thinking of it from a broader, much broader perspective. So for example, in the age of social media, you can have people wearing that brand, showing off that brand, being visible at certain events, for example. I'll give you an example. So there's a major angel investor and VC in Silicon Valley, and he does he used to do many large conferences in the Bay Area that would host 5, 10, 15, 20,000 people. What some podcasters would do was they wouldn't register for the conference. They would hang out in the lobby and interview people at the conference as if they were at the conference. So they're basically leveraging, I call it newsjacking. So they're leveraging the brand awareness and visibility of that conference for their personal brand. There's a way to do that with luxury as well. For example, you know, being in Paris for Fashion Week, you may not have the budget for a runway show, but you may have influencers and models that are wearing those clothes in Paris during Fashion Week, and you could create a news story through that. So I think it's possible to launch a brand without traditional testimonials from celebrities or comments visually. But I think it's absolutely possible, especially in today's age of TikTok and being very media savvy.
Thank you. What I also meant was, is it possible for you to launch a luxury brand without actually gifting your product to influencers and to people that would perhaps wear it for free? Or would you say, actually, no, that's actually part of the strategy. That's how what I've seen a lot of these super luxury brands do. They gift the product to Kim Kardashian, or I don't know, to someone super influential, and then they gift it to their friend, and then perhaps Kim Kardashian will see that and be like, oh my God, this is amazing. So then they will get free PR from that. Would you say that's part of the strategy for a luxury brand? Like, you cannot really get it around unless you use some sort of free gifting strategy.
That's one strategy. However, I'm a big believer in having your customers pay from day one. That validates that there is demand, that validates that you're building value, that validates that customers will pay you for your product. So I launched a consulting company as fractional CFO consulting company, and within 30 days we were at five figures in revenue. Customers were willing to pay from day one. They saw the value that we were providing. We provided a solution to a pain point that they had, closing their financials and bookkeeping, and they're willing to pay from day one. So you can launch via gifting and influencing. However, I think it's important to have validation from day one in terms of customer payment. I will say this though, it's a very different business launching a problem business, for example, financial reporting or bookkeeping, versus launching a luxury clothing line. I would look at a luxury clothing line as a want, not a problem that needs to be solved. So I think it'll be a little bit different than launching a traditional business, what I'm thinking of in terms of, I believe bootstrapping is optimized for traditional proven businesses that solve a real pain point. It could be a financial pain point, it could be, a plumbing pain point, you know, things of that nature, sort of traditional problems. Luxury items, I'm not sure that bootstrapping will be the best method, because it's difficult to ask a customer to pay $3,000 for a purse if they've never seen it before, if they've never heard of it before, they've never worn it before, they don't know the craftsmanship, they don't know the history of the brand. It's not impossible, but I think that the little bit higher bar for customers to actually make that impact.
Thank you. For coaches that want to make $1 million with their coaching services, would you say that it's important they try to get paying customers from day one, or that they would get the first 5 to 10 coaching clients for free and they would gift their coaching service so that they would get some testimonials and then leverage those testimonials in order to get paid clients?
I don't see why both paths can't be pursued at the same time. So initially you want and need a social proof for success. So if that means gifting your service away in the beginning, I'm not opposed to that. However, and most likely that's also ideal, probably for your friends and family, correct? However, if you can find people who have a specific pain point in your coaching, whatever you're coaching for, and are willing to pay you on day one, I think that's far more stronger, because it has social proof. Because your friends may do you a favor and do you a solid and give you a testimonial, but then how will you convert that to actual revenue? So I don't see a problem in pursuing both paths concurrently.
Thank you. How do you go from zero to your first 10K in revenue fast without capital, aside from everything you just mentioned? Let's say, take for example, for a coaching business.
Gotcha. So how do you go from zero to 10K fast for a coaching business without venture capital? Yeah. So great question. I would say, one, define what problem you're solving. What are you coaching for? who is your, define who your audience is, who is your ideal customer profile, your ICP, where are they? Are they on Reddit? Are they on LinkedIn? Are they on Substack, right? And then presenting, talking, engaging with those customers, potential customers, that audience, to find out what are they willing to pay for coaching for. For example, I know there's one coach who does regular coaching on how to become a notary, right? So lots of people need a notary for example, for wills, for purchasing a home, etc. So he has a coaching business around setting up a notary business. So he has a newsletter, he's on LinkedIn, he's on forums, people looking for. So there's a way to, one, finding your customers, finding out what alternative for that product is, how much are they charging, and that can give you a sense of what you can charge, and then engaging with that audience from day one. Now, in terms of bootstrapping, when I talk about bootstrapping, there are many ways to bootstrap, as I mentioned. There's credit cards, there's customer prepayments, there's bank loans, things of that nature. From a coaching business, you probably don't need any of those. You can have your customers give you that first amount. The other thing you can do as well is you can do step scaling, right? So for example, if you know you want to charge, you know, $1,000 for, you know, a 4-week coaching program, perhaps you start at $250, you know, get customers in, get testimonials, prove that it works, find out what customers are really actually willing to pay, and then you could scale up appropriately. So there's no wrong answer. It's a matter of how your product positioning is, and then who your customer profile is for getting that coaching business off the ground.
Thank you. How do you get your first coaching client if you have no testimonial and no track record?
Sure. So how do you get your first coaching client? Sure. I would start with reaching out to friends and family. So defining what problem you're solving, reaching out to your friends and family and saying, hey, I'm building this coaching business around, you know, starting a notary, for example. Do you know anybody that would you be willing to pay for it? Or do you know anybody that would be willing to pay for it? That's one. Second, there are great tools out there that you can actually scrape your entire Gmail account for all your email addresses, for the entire history of your Gmail account. So that probably would be like, you know, 5 or 10,000 email addresses. You can scrape that, start a newsletter announcing that you're forming this coaching business, for example, on being a notary, and then you have 5,000 people. Open rates are usually between 1% and 3%. So based upon that, you may find your first customer, or there may be a referral. Another way is to, once again, spend time on where these coaching customer clients are. Are they on TikTok? Are they on Reddit? Going on these Reddit forums, adding value before you start actually asking for revenue, right? Demonstrating that you're actually an expert in that coaching space. Another way to demonstrate that value is also on Quora as well. So between Reddit and Quora, positioning yourself as an expert, and then, you know, I say like 5-to-1 ratio. So 5 times you add value, answers people's questions, help point them in the right direction. And then for every 5 posts of those, one of those posts you talk about, this is the service that I'm offering that solves this problem.
Thank you. How do you deal with, let's say, coaching clients that want to get your coaching, but cannot afford you? Let's say they can only afford 20% of what mm-hmm. you want to charge. How do you deal with that problem?
Sure. So it depends on where you are in your coaching journey and how valuable that customer is. So perhaps you can do an installment. So I was working with somebody who was starting a coaching business, and one of the feedback that they got from a potential customer is, I love your service, I want to be a part of it, but I can't pay for it all up front. Is there a way to do buy now, pay later? And I said, absolutely, there's a way to do buy now, pay later. So that's a way to do it. So either buy now, pay later. You can also do installment plans. PayPal has installment plans. Affirm has installment plans as well. So that's another option. Another option is to do a partnership with clients. So if that client wants to book you, but they only can pay 20%, is there something else that they can barter with? Can they give you a video testimonial? Can they give you a written testimonial? Can they refer you to 5 other of their friends or clients that can make up that revenue? So there are other ways. It's all about being creative and finding a way to close a deal, especially if you're starting out at the beginning. Most coaching people have a cold start problem, right? So how do you start that business? So one way is to be creative about your financing and creative about working with customers that are of value to you.
Thank you. How can someone make their first $1 million with a membership, perhaps leveraging AI?
Sure. So that's quite easy. There are many masterminds for different verticals, right? There's masterminds on setting up an ad agency. There are masterminds on getting your first $1 million client. So in the age of AI, you can actually prompt the AI to coach you step by step on how to set up a coaching program. You could prompt the AI to coach you step by step on how to set up your membership program. And you can prompt the not only just to give you the answers, but to engage with you to say, okay, what are your core areas of expertise? Where do you have domain expertise in? And which of those domain areas can you actually generate real revenue from that is a profitable revenue that'll get you to $1 million? The other thing too is also defining like within what time frame you're looking to make that $1 million. It's probably ambitious to make that in a month, but it's probably doable in 1 to 2 years, depending on what you're charging and what the membership program is. And then more importantly, what value you're adding, right? Because at the end of the day, it really comes down to value add. Do your customers feel that you're adding value, and are you able to demonstrate that value where they feel that whatever they're paying you is worth it?
Thank you. How can someone expand if, let's say, they have already their first 50 customers, and how can they find their first 1,000 customers, from 50 to 1,000 customers, for example? Where can they go, and what activities do they need to do?
Sure. So there are many things you could do. I'm going to give you a generic answer, but it really depends on what product or service you're offering.
So let's take coaching. Let's take coaching a business again.
Okay, so you want to go with coaching, a coaching business. So they have 50 customers and they want to get to 1,000 customers. So for expanding the customer base, there are many ways you can do it. So probably one of the most efficient ways to doing it is affiliate marketing. So partnering with affiliates, so and then doing a revenue share. So for every customer that somebody brings you, they get, you know, a percentage of the revenue. So you give them a referral code or a link, and they book through that link, and then they earn 1, 10, 20, 50% of what they bring in. Obviously, the higher the percentage point, the more incentivized they are to do so. That's one option. The other option is being visible. So being visible, for example, on podcasts like this, being visible, blogging, creating a newsletter, going to where your customers, meet your customers where they are. Where do your customers spend, potential customers spend their time, and being visible there. For example, this week in Las Vegas, there is the Adobe AI conference and the Google Cloud AI conference. If you're doing a coaching business on AI, it'd be imperative for you to be at those conferences this week. And perhaps you can be on a speaking panel. Perhaps you can be in the audience. Perhaps you can be networking with customers in the lobby area, for example. So being creative and coming outside the box. So to expand from 50 to 1,000 customers, it depends on, it's a coaching business. What segment are you in? Where are your customers? How can you meet them where they are? And then, you know, also, you, in addition to affiliate program with, for example, influencers, you can also have an affiliate program with existing customers. So if they found value in what you provided, have them refer you to, they have a friend or a family member or a coworker who may be interested in the product or service that you're offering. And that'll help expand your customer base from 50 to 1,000 customers.
Thank you. How do you become a super attractor of customer leads without having to work for it, without having to chase them? And how do you turn the wheel around so that they are chasing you? How do you become irresistible to your customers?
Sure. How do you become irresistible to your customers? So it's about demonstrating expertise in the space, demonstrating dominance, being the brand leader in that space, being the authoritative voice. So how do you become the authority? So if you're the authority on coaching for being a notary, have you written a book on being a notary? Do you have a newsletter on being a notary? Do you have a blog on being a notary? Do you have successful customers that have gone through your coaching program and set up their own notary businesses? Is there an annual notary conference, and are you there as part of the speaking engagement on the panels, for example? So being a super attractor and generating leads is ideally, you want customers to find you versus you finding customers. And that's being visible, and that's being dominant, and that's being an authority. For example, you know, perhaps you start a newsletter on LinkedIn, perhaps you start a newsletter on Substack, perhaps you post on a daily basis. But posting for the sake of posting is not really adding value. So how are you solving the customer's problem? What are you giving away for free? What insights are you sharing? Say you giving? How are you, for example, helping people, for example, say it's a coaching on being a notary. How are you giving them advice on what's happening around the corner, for example, leveraging AI for being a notary? You know, so being a part of the conversation and being a thought leader and authority in that space will help you become a super attractor and then get inbound leads. And then also, most importantly, having a quick way for people to contact you. Do you have a QR code? Do you have a website? Do you have an email? Where can they find you? And how can they engage with you? And then, and have a product or service offering they can engage with right away.
Thank you. What are the worst mistakes you've seen people do to make their first $1 million without capital raise?
Sure. Worst mistakes to make their first million without capital raise. There are many. How much time do you have? I would say one mistake I see is people chasing investors instead of chasing customers. So that's one mistake. I would say also focusing on things like polishing a pitch deck as opposed to finding customers and solving a problem. Having an idea versus having a business is a very big difference. You can have a great idea, but it may not be a good business. Another mistake I've seen is underfunding. So it's important to understand your funnel and how much money does it take to run and operate your business. So what I've seen is that the startups that succeed are the ones that last. And the ones that last are efficient in managing their money. So however much money it is, making sure that money lasts. I would also say the worst mistakes are over leveraging on credit cards. Credit card interest rates are very high. So I would use that as a last resort. Also, people spending their savings and their retirement savings without defining a cap of, okay, I want to, you know, only spend 10 or 20% of my savings on this, and then, you know, figure out other ways to generate revenue. Another mistake I see is people quitting their jobs too early. A lot of what people don't talk about is a lot of times people have a day job and then they have a side hustle. And then when the side hustle takes off, then they leave their day job. So sometimes people quit their day job before the business has revenue, before the business has customers, before the business has traction. So those are some of the mistakes I've made. One final mistake I've seen is also saying yes to the wrong customers. If customers aren't willing to pay you what you're worth, or if the customer is very difficult, or the customer takes a lot of time to say yes and commit, that may not be your customer. So saying yes to the right customers versus random clients or extremely customized work that isn't a standard product offering, because that takes you off your critical path.
Thank you. How can an entrepreneur bounce back after financial failure? And I'm talking, for example, starting a business that doesn't quite pan out, and perhaps starting multiple businesses that don't quite pan out. And how does an entrepreneur get that energy, motivation, drive, and belief in themselves again to face the world after big failures?
Yeah. So basically, big failure, and then how do they bounce back? So I would say from a big failure, I think it would be important to take a step back and pause and reflect. What worked well? What didn't work well? What mistakes did they make? What decisions did they not make that would have put the business going forward? So taking stock of where you are and then learning from that going forward. It's also important to, as you relaunch and sort of business, not repeat those mistakes. So identify if you didn't have enough runway for the business capital to keep you going, making sure you have enough runway. If there were complaints about the product offering from the customers, or they didn't see a transformation if you're doing a coaching business, making sure you solve that problem. So I would say you need to do a deep audit of a root cause analysis of everything that went wrong with the business. Was it people? Was it process? Was it technology? And then fix those leaky holes in the bolt, and then relaunch with a new strategy and don't repeat those mistakes again.
Thank you. And how do you get the motivation to be motivated again when they are actually demotivated? Because let's say if you worked really hard for 5 years and then ultimately you lost everything, it's like there is a big demotivation there. Like, how do you get that energy and drive to come back from that?
Absolutely. Sometimes it takes time to heal. So it may not make sense for you to, if your business failed yesterday, you don't want to go ahead and start a business again tomorrow. You may take time to heal and reflect. And also, it may be an opportunity to reskill, right? Usually when things fail, it's either people, process, or technology. So what failed? Is there an opportunity to reskill? Is there an opportunity to rethink? So the motivation, where does that come from? The motivation comes from within. The motivation comes from taking time to heal. The motivation comes from taking time to reflect. Also, it's important to have a friend group, a family group, a support group of other people, your peers in that space. Understand what they're doing that works well. Get insights and ideas. And then once you've had time to heal and process and come up with a revised game plan, you can launch. But it may not make sense to launch right away. But I would say the motivation definitely comes from within, but also observing what's happening around you and rethinking and reimagining what your product, service, or coaching business should be.
Thank you. How does an entrepreneur cope with rejection? Now, one funny example is, okay, like I'm noticing, like there are guys that have asked me out like 100 times. There are others that have asked me out like 50 times and they're not giving up. And I'm thinking that in the same way, one has to be very relentless in their business and not get not get upset when kind of like when a customer says no. And I'm wondering whether you have like a similar opinion or just about asking the right people who will say yes. And you, for example, in your case, have you ever felt demotivated by a rejection? And if so, how did you overcome it?
Sure. So the question's around rejection. So we all experience rejection in our lives. So it's not what happens to you, but how you react to it. Rejection, if you're doing a coaching business, is an opportunity to reflect, is my messaging wrong? Is my positioning wrong? Is my pricing wrong? Is my product wrong? Is my branding wrong? Is my logo wrong? And reevaluating and relaunching based upon that rejection. So rejection is an opportunity. For example, for those that want to ignore my advice about bootstrapping and go straight to venture capital or angel investors for money, that's fine. I would say rejection is actually a benefit. And here's why. When a VC tells you no, or an angel tells you no right away, you don't have to spend time chasing them. You move on to people that'll say yes. So rejection can be a tool, a catalyst, a fuel, and motivation to keep going because you're focusing on the yeses. You don't dwell on the no's. You want to understand why they're saying no. Is the product too early? Does it not solve their problem? Understand why the rejection, if you can get an answer to the rejection, but you can use that as fuel to move forward.
Thank you. How do you leverage joint venture partners to grow your business to $1 million? Imagine that some joint venture partners that you want to collaborate with, some of them misunderstand you. Some of them think you're trying to take advantage and you're really not. And others are really wonderful. Is it that you have to just take it on the chin that some people will misunderstand you regardless of your great intentions and just collaborate with the ones that are aligned with your mission and your vision and everything you're doing? Is it just like a case of, you know, just accept that some people will misunderstand you and some people will be just wonderful for whatever you're trying to do at the time?
Yeah. So joint ventures are tricky. You've got to determine if you both have the same alignment and motivation. I think it's important to understand what do they want out of the transaction? What do you want out of the transaction? And are you both aligned? And is what you both want realistic and possible and achievable? That's step one. Number two, I think it's important to develop a relationship with the joint venture partner well before you do the joint venture. Make sure you're aligned about how you do business, what kind of business you do, what's their tone and tenor of doing business, what's their integrity, what's their capability in terms of paying you your portion in a timely fashion, what's their history, what are their reviews and ratings from customers, employees, and other joint venture partners that they worked with in the past. So I think it's important to build a relationship and perform due diligence with joint ventures before you engage with them. It's also important to just explicitly define what that joint venture looks like in terms of what a success look like. And then also have that tough conversation of when will we decide if this joint venture does not make sense? And then how do we get out of this joint venture if it doesn't make sense? For example, if it's for a 24-month period or a 36-month period, what are the key milestones or metrics that are being defined for partnership? So I think it's important to have those conversations first before you engage in a joint venture. And then once you engage in the joint venture, I think it's also important to have continuing ongoing conversations. Is this working for you? Is this working for me? Are we both making money? Do we both see the value add in us partnering in this joint venture? So I think those are the kind of questions you need to ask when engaging in a joint venture.
Thank you. How do you avoid aligning yourself or doing business with the wrong people? And I'm talking, for example, it sounds ideal that you can check reviews and you can find all this information, but a lot of times you cannot because you don't have their, you're not part of their network. So, I mean, I'm regularly meeting new people, new seemingly amazing people, and I'm always trying to collaborate in some way. And sometimes I get burned and sometimes no, sometimes it pans out well. But I don't generally have the luxury of having all this information that you talked about in terms of reviews and seeing whether these people will pay me or not. So a lot of times it's just a matter of like trying the first time, trying a few times and then seeing kind of getting that feedback. So, and the other thing I've missed is that sometimes I align with the wrong people and I felt so bad. And the reason I felt so bad was because I introduced them to my network in Mexico and Peru and London and Singapore. And like, they were like everywhere. And because of that, at some point, like I was invited to speak in front of 100,000 students in Peru at a university online. And then I actually declined it because that person was going to be there. And I mean, I still don't know whether I did took the right decision to just pull out of a lot of different opportunities that were literally designed for me. And I just didn't want to see that person anymore. But I'm saying like sometimes aligning with the wrong people can have such detrimental impact on your business. And it's almost, it feels like you cannot really come out of that circle anymore because that person is entrenched. So like, what's the alternative? Like, do you just have to accept that sometimes you will align with the wrong people, you will get bitten in the ass, and then you have to just survive the best that you can and then make better choices next time? Or what do you suggest doing?
Yeah, it's a tough situation because you do a joint venture or partnership with somebody and you have the best intentions and they have the best intentions, and then things change, people change, situations change, money changes, and then all of a sudden you don't have the outcome that you wanted. How do you avoid the wrong people? There's no way to avoid the wrong people because you don't know who the wrong people are. I'd say first, trust your gut. In the situations where you have data points to perform due diligence or you don't have customer testimonials, one way to do it is to perform a pilot. Okay, we're going to do a joint venture of, you know, selling, you know, 100,000 tractors. Let's do two tractors and see how long they sell. So you do a small pilot and you did. And this pilot would be good for 90 days. How long does it take to sell those two tractors? Are they transparent with you? Are they communicative with you? Do they pay you the percentage that they agreed to pay you? Do they pay you in a timely fashion? Are they difficult to deal with? Are they transparent? And then you do those two tractors in 90 days, that works out. Okay, next you do four tractors in 120 days. So if you don't have data points, one way to do it is to do small pilots. And even so, you can do pilots and people can be on their best behavior during pilots. And then when the big $1 million deal comes, you see a different side of them. But I think that's one way to help mitigate the risk. The other way to mitigate the risk is to do back channel reference checks. That's a common thing in Silicon Valley, where I spent a decade. And so if you worked at, for example, Google for 10 years and now you're going to Apple and you were on the, you know, software engineering team in Cupertino, specifically working on the iPad, they will go on your LinkedIn. They will see who you're connected to from Google or, you know, whatever back then, contact the person, say, hey, I'm thinking of partnering with Lily. I saw that you and her were on the same team at Google in, you know, 2022. Do you have 10 minutes to answer some questions? You know, it's all off the record. That's a quite common thing in Silicon Valley. Is it right? It's dependable, but there are a lot of back channel reference checks that happens. That may be one way to address the problem.
Thank you. How do you become an efficient relationship master so you can leverage the relationships in your life to create win-win partnerships over the long term? What are some important traits you need to have as a person and or develop as a person so you can become a great relationship master that is adding value to the people in your life and at the same time you are creating win-win collaborations over the long term?
Sure. So the question is around efficient relationship master. So at the end of the day, it's about defining what success looks like for you. Give me some more color on this. Like in relationship master, you're talking about business relationships? Are you talking about adventures? Are you talking about?
Business relationships.
And so when you say efficient relationship master, what do you mean by that specifically? Give me examples by that.
So how do you become this kind of master of relationships where you are able to quickly create new relationships that you turn into cash for both parties? And you also become known for being like a great networker that is trusted, that is credible, that is, you know, is respected, admired. And also people kind of like trust you to kind of go, okay, I have $100 million deal here. Who do you know? Or you know what I mean? Like, here's who I know that I can introduce you to for this. And you know what I mean? Like, how do you quickly make this happen?
Sure. I'm not sure there's a quick way to make that happen because big deals require big trust, which is developed over time, not over a bar and two drinks, right? So I think that's something that that's developed over time with your network, with adding value, with trust. And once again, with testimonials, people can say, I worked with Lily. Lily helped me scale my business from 10,000 customers to 100,000 customers over the past 2 years. So I would say use the mantra of adding value before you ask for a favor. Finding out who do you want to build relationships with? What problems do they have? And how can you help them solve their problems? Right? Either with, you know, labor, maybe you've got the time and bandwidth, maybe with your network, maybe with your knowledge, right? So building relationships by adding value, and then at some point asking for reciprocation of that value that you added.
Thank you. Tell us where entrepreneurs can connect with you.
Sure. I'm on LinkedIn. So Mwe Malombe at LinkedIn. I'm also on X as Mwe Malombe. So those are the primary two areas. My book is also available on Amazon. So if you Google my name, Mwe Malombe, the Bootstrap Funding Playbook is also available on Amazon. So those are probably the three primary areas you can find me.
Thank you.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.